You're Matthew Phillips.
And you're Nick D'Souza.
And this is the
A-Level Politics Show.
Welcome back to Series 4. So you can hear the building works in the background, folks. We are at Reigate College. We're about to start the academic year. We are in P106. And I'm so pleased to welcome back Matthew Phillips to the show. Matthew, how was your summer?
It was great, thank you. And yours?
Really good, thanks. I went to the Isle of Wight and I found out that the Isle of Wight is the largest parliamentary constituency in the UK as things stand, with 140,000 registered voters. I found this out looking on my phone while the rest of my family were looking over a beautiful sunset on Topland Bay. So clearly you can see where my interests lie. How about you? Get up to anything fun?
Yeah, what sticks out is going to the Royal Opera House to see Bill Bailey.
Fantastic.
Very much part of the liberal metropolitan elite scene there.
Great.
Lots of a real diverse group of people there, though, I think.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
Well, that's,
maybe not surprisingly, I don't know.
That's wonderful. But of course, no one cares about what we've done over the summer. What they really care about is UK democracy, and is it in a democratic deficit? So that is the focus of this new podcast, this new series. We're going to go back over old podcast shows that we've done and update them, because politics is an active subject. So bear with us, folks. I'm just going to tell you exactly how this is going to work. Firstly, we are going to say what we think. So Matthew is going to be arguing that democracy in the UK is not in deficit, that it's working really well, whereas I am going to be arguing that it's working incredibly badly and it's getting worse. And then it's up to you, dear listener, to decide what you think. So here we go. First of all, what is a democratic deficit? Well, Neil McNaughton refers to it as features of the political system which do not conform to or fall short of the normal criteria for a true democracy. And we are going to look at four such criteria today. We'll be looking at free and fair elections and whether the UK has them. We'll be looking at parliamentary democracy and whether Parliament is doing its job. We'll also be looking at rights and whether they are well protected in the UK. And we'll be finishing up on healthy participation and whether there is healthy political participation in the UK. So bear with us, folks. After the break, Matthew is going to be telling us exactly why he thinks free and fair elections are alive and well, and why he just loves democracy in the UK. Over to you, Matthew. Free and fair elections.
So here we're going to look at voting rights, the franchise, who can vote, and I think it's very difficult to argue that here there is a democratic deficit. Certainly a democratic deficit that we would have seen maybe 100 years ago. 100 years ago, women would have only just been given the vote, and only certain women who owned property. But now, ever since 1969, everyone over the age of 18 can vote, no matter your sex, no matter what race you are, what religion you are. Everyone has the same right to vote. Now, you add on to that what we have seen in recent times is that more and more people are getting involved in elections. And there's a whole range of different elections as well that we're getting involved in. We've got elections not just for the House of Commons. We have elections to elect the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Parliament, the Northern Irish Assembly. You can elect your local mayor, the Mayor of London. So we've got lots of opportunities to vote, and we see an increasing number of people getting involved in them.
Is it easy to vote as well in the UK?
I would say it's very easy to vote in the UK. Different elections use different systems. But I think most people in the UK understand how those elections work. And they're free and fair. There's no pressure on you on how you vote. There's no one telling you how to vote. If you don't want to tell someone how you voted, you don't have to. It's completely secret, free and fair.
Well, thank you for that, Matthew. That would be really wonderful if any of that was actually true. The first past the post electoral system for general elections is unfair and leads to the winning party enjoying a disproportionate share of the seats. For example, the Conservatives won 37% of the vote in the 2015 general election, but 51% of the seats in Parliament, allowing them to dominate when actually they didn't have popular support above 40%. Meanwhile, in 2019, the Liberal Democrats received almost 12% of the vote. So surely they should get 12% of the seats. But no, they got 2% of the seats. Matthew didn't tell you that. I wonder why. So in terms of fairness, UK elections do not appear to be fair because of this first past the post system that UK general elections, the most important election, has. Equally, there are growing concerns about how free UK elections are. Matthew mentioned that 100 years ago, women couldn't vote. That's true, they now can, they can vote. But 16 and 17 year olds, most of the people listening to this podcast, cannot vote. And in a world where young people can do ever more things, it seems strange to not allow them to vote in England. In Scotland and in Wales, young people can vote in regional elections, assembly elections. And I ask you, Matthew, I simply ask you, why can't 16 to 17 year olds vote in general elections if Scottish and Welsh voters who are that age can vote in, say, the Scottish parliamentary elections or perhaps the most important referendum of our lifetime, the Scottish independence referendum, where 16 and 17 year olds were allowed to vote? Now, I will shut up in a second so you can come back. But I want to stick with this issue of fairness. The 2021 elections bill currently going before Parliament has two very concerning elements. The first one is a new requirement for voter ID that could suppress voter turnout, and particularly in areas where fewer people have authenticated ID, such as passports and driving licenses, because they cost money. I'm thinking about inner city areas where people use public transport and they therefore don't have driving licenses, or where people can't afford, in poorer areas where people can't afford to travel, so therefore don't have passports. So in those areas where you're less likely to have that authenticated ID, you may well have people not being able to vote. And those areas, by the way, happen to be areas that are not well disposed to voting Conservative. I wonder why the Conservative Party is introducing this bill, therefore. The second worrying aspect to the 2021 elections bill are measures to weaken the independence of the Electoral Commission, which supervises elections and punishes election malpractice in this country. It's a body that investigates breaches of election law and political donations, and the plans as they stand will place the Electoral Commission basically below that of politicians, and politicians will have a greater say on how that commission is run. And that is worrying because the independence of the Electoral Commission ensures that we have fair elections and ensures that elections are free. So therefore, my view is that elections are not free and fair. Matthew, do you want to come back on any of that?
Yeah, there's two things that I think you've raised. You've raised very good points. The first one that we heard was about elections and, in particular, first past the post. It leads to a disproportionate result, and that might well be true, but it's perhaps the least worst option out there. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that it delivers a majority government. You don't really get this with other systems, at least not always. That means that you will very often get a strong and, dare I say, stable government, like we have right now, the Conservative government with an 80-seat majority that can deliver on what it promised in its manifesto. And it's very important to keep those manifesto promises, like governments always do. The other thing that you mentioned were the Liberal Democrats. You mentioned Liberal Democrats, they are very negatively impacted by first past the post. You could have said the Greens, Brexit Party as well, are all negatively impacted by first past the post. And I agree with you, but maybe it's not just first past the post. Maybe it's problems with their leadership. Maybe their policies are not popular. Or maybe, quite simply, we want a system that keeps out smaller parties to prevent extremist parties from doing well. The other thing you mentioned just before I finish up is about 16 and 17 year olds. Now, we are blessed teaching A-level politics that we have 16 and 17 and 18 year olds who know a lot about politics, who want to express their views, but not all 16 and 17 year olds are in that position. One argument goes that they could be influenced by their friends or maybe their family. Maybe that will be less likely when you are a little bit older. The other thing you could say also is you want to lower their voting age to 16 and 17. Maybe they could wait 1 or 2 years when they get 18, when they become 18. And we widely view 18 as the age when you are an adult.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because by following that logic through, you would then have to ban 16 and 17 year olds in Wales and Scotland from voting, even though now they can vote. So if we say there should be a national age of voting, then we will be taking away the right to vote for 16 and 17 year olds. I take your point completely that maybe the woes of the Lib Dems are that they're not popular enough, but they were 12% of the vote. They won 12% of the vote. And I'm not sure we can say the Lib Dems are extremist. So they are the party that consistently
extreme remainers
lose out. But also, I suppose this goes to the heart of the debate. What is democracy? Is democracy about ensuring we have a government? And there is a logical argument for that. And if we judge that, we make that criteria, then yes, we have a democracy because first past the post and elections deliver government. I suppose the other view is what type of government have we got, though? Have we got a government that's perhaps too domineering and too strong and too able to affect change without the will of the people being reflected? On to the next debate, and that is parliamentary democracy.
Okay, Nick, well, let's look at Parliament then.
Let's.
So when we look at Parliament, we want to look at certain different features. We want to ask ourselves, is it representative of the UK? And 100% it is. And it's increasingly moving in a positive direction. We've got more women in the House of Commons than ever before. We have more people from a black, Asian and minority ethnic group than ever before. We have more people who from the LGBT plus community as well.
And that's good, isn't it? Because for a democracy to be considered a democracy, you have to have representation.
Yeah, so they look like the UK, they sound like the UK, they are coming from increasingly the same sort of backgrounds as people in the UK, as people in the UK as well. The second thing, we want to have a parliament that is making laws. And a positive feature there is because we've got MPs and people from the House of Lords there, they are scrutinising laws. There's a range of mechanisms for them to do that. I think it's very important that we very often have a majority government that can deliver on their manifesto promises. Something that we don't always see in the United States is very often a lot of gridlock, very few laws being passed, whereas in the UK, a majority government very often can deliver on their promises. I would also say, when we're looking at making laws, that this is where the House of Lords comes in, because you've got a range of people in the House of Lords who are able to offer their expertise and experience and make sure that the laws are really going to work. You look at the House of Lords, you've got former politicians like Michael Heseltine. You've got people for like David Blunkett from the Labour Party in there. You've got people from business like Lord Bird, founder and owner of The Big Issue, Karen Brady as well. You've got a range of different people from a range of different perspectives. You've even got scientists like Robert Winston, a leading IVF scientist. So you've got a range of people who can all offer their experience and expertise to make sure that Parliament is making laws that work. You wanted to come in, I think.
Yeah, well, if democracy was about passing laws, then I suppose we have to say Nazi Germany was a democracy. For me, parliamentary democracy or having a parliament that is democratic is one that properly holds the government to account and ensures that what happens in Germany, in Nazi Germany, cannot happen here. And we have something in this country called the fusion of powers, and that is where the executive, the government, sits in parliament and dominates it. You don't have that in the US. The president is separate from their Congress, their legislature. But in this country, the executive sits in the legislature, and that means the government can force through measures that have not been properly scrutinised. So when I'm thinking of democracy, I'm thinking of parliamentary scrutiny, not just parliament being able to pass laws. We can come on to what you said, Matthew, about representation in a second, but I just want to give a few examples here. The 2016 Trade Union Act and the 2016 Investigatory Powers Act, both examples of laws that alter the rights of citizens and increase the power of government. And you could also say that the policing bill currently going before London that limits the right of protest by giving police more powers to disband them are all laws that affect the rights of citizens that are not being scrutinised properly because we have a government that is able to dominate Parliament and force things through. And we can see that the return of that strong majority government following the 2019 general election is going to lead to further passing of laws with weak scrutiny. Let's talk about representation as well. I completely take your point that the House of Commons is becoming more representative in the sense that it looks a little bit more like the general public it serves. We have more women in Parliament than ever before, but actually only 34% of our MPs are actually women. Last time I checked, women were 50% plus of the population. Equally, you mentioned the House of Lords. It's completely unelected, and some peers are there because their parents were there, their hereditary peers. And the House of Lords is weak, which allows the government to push through its agenda even more quickly. And so we do have a very efficient parliament in the sense that it passes laws, but my point is that I do not feel that they are scrutinised effectively enough. Anything to add on that, Matthew, or do you just acknowledge that I'm completely right in all things?
Well, I think it's very important that with the fusion of powers, it is true that you'll have a government and a strong government, but perhaps that's one of the really positive features of our democracy, that we have the government in the House of Commons. That means that they can be scrutinised, they can face questions. In America, they don't have anything like Prime Minister's questions that happens every Wednesday, 12 o'clock. You have the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, facing questions from a range of different MPs. And we have that in the UK because of the fusion of powers. So they are constantly being scrutinised. The other thing I wanted to say was about scrutiny as well, and having governments that you said can basically get whatever they want done. And in some cases that is true, but there's a lot of things. I mean, even under Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson's Conservative government has an 80-seat majority, but there's been a lot of things that he has wanted to do that he's not been able to do. If you think about, for example, allowing Huawei to have a massive role in the rollout of 5G, that was something that he had to climb down from and U-turn on because there was a lot of pressure from MPs to back up on that.
Yeah, yes, okay. But MPs ultimately still voted in favour of that, and it was pressure from the Americans that led to that particular company being barred, the Chinese company Huawei, being barred from being part of the rollout of 5G in the UK. But I take your point, there's been lots of U-turns with the Boris Johnson government. The problem I have is that those U-turns have come about as a result of party disunity in the Conservative Party, i.e. we are relying on scrutiny coming from Conservative MPs who make up the government. Because they dominate Parliament so much, we are not getting that same kind of political power being exercised by other parties. We are becoming a one-party state as a result of this electoral system that leads to huge majorities for the winning party. And at the moment, the party that is benefiting from that electoral system is just one party, the Conservative Party. And that is worrying, I feel, for competition. And I think democracy should be about competition. Can you see, Matthew, can you see the next election going to another party, another party winning it? Can you see the next election?
No, I can't. I can't predict the future. But I think maybe, coming to that last point there, maybe it's right that the Conservative Party is strong. After all, it received more votes than any other party. And it wouldn't feel quite right if other parties had a significant amount of power, given that they didn't win as many votes.
Well, we will leave it there, even though you're completely wrong. We will leave it there. And we will go on to rights in the UK. Are they adequately protected? So Matthew, on to rights. This country protects rights. Tell me how.
So I think first of all, it's important to look at what we mean by rights. And very often it's very useful to look at different examples of rights. We've got the right of education in the UK, the right to vote, right to privacy as well. We've also got certain freedoms and liberties as well. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association and joining trade unions as well. So we've got a lot of rights and a lot of freedoms in this country that we may not enjoy had we been born elsewhere or live elsewhere. All of those rights are protected by the Human Rights Act of 1998, and that gives the judiciary, the courts in this country, a lot of power to make sure that our rights are protected. Sometimes even groups that might otherwise be exploited or forgotten about as well. I would say that power of the courts to protect our rights has only been strengthened over time, thanks to a range of different measures. They are more independent, they're more neutral, and able to take on the government and protect our rights.
Well, is it my turn?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Go ahead.
Protection of rights. Well, Stuart Weir writes that the rule of law is what the government says it is. And it goes back really to what I was talking about, first past the post and elections, and how it seems to benefit the ruling party, because it all links to it. The ruling party win under first past the post. They then dominate Parliament, the law-making body of the UK. And therefore, they can change those laws easily. And therefore, they can change our rights easily. Let's talk about the freedom of the press. Now, the press have the ability to investigate politicians and investigate wrongdoing. And one of the tools they can use is the Freedom of Information Act. They can request documents be released into the public domain if there is a public interest in doing so. But the government, with its majority, has weakened the Freedom of Information Act. In fact, successive governments have done that. The Freedom of Information Act has been watered down by the government. So our freedom to find out what information the government has on us, or the press freedom to find out what the government is doing, is limited. The Guardian, for example, was not allowed to publish details about Saudi arms deals because arms deals are not covered in the Freedom of Information Act. They are exempt. And also, because we have an unentrenched constitution, because, and that means that there is no higher law other than Parliament, and whoever controls Parliament therefore dictates what the law should be, laws that you mentioned there, like the Human Rights Act, can simply be scrapped by a simple act of Parliament. And the Tories have promised to update the Human Rights Act in their 2019 manifesto. And by update, I don't think they mean strengthen. I've already mentioned the 2021 policing bill that gives extensive powers to police to crack down on peaceful protest. That's a very important right. So those COVID restrictions on the right to protest appear here to stay. You may have remembered the Sarah Everard vigil on Clapham Common last summer, where the police broke up a peaceful vigil. You may well expect to see more things like that happen as we give police more and more powers. A democracy is not one that conveys more powers to the police. It is one that actually gives less. It is not one that ensures governments dominate the laws that are made in the country. It is one that ensures there's checks and balances so that those laws do not interfere with the rights of the citizen. Over to you, Matthew.
Yes, so I think there's three main points that you make there. The first one was about the Freedom of Information Act, and you sort of make my point for me, really. We have the Freedom of Information Act. It helps to make our political system more transparent. Because of the Freedom of Information Act, it revealed, or because of the Daily Telegraph, used the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to find out about the expenses scandal and the misuse of public funds, for example.
I'm waving my finger at Matthew, but yeah.
I thought it was sort of a Beyonce tribute.
Yeah, I'm sort of a Beyonce star waving my finger, because if you were to look at all the documents released under the Freedom of Information Act about the expenses scandal that showed all the money that MPs were using to do up their homes and then sell them and make a profit off them, virtually every document was redacted, i.e. they were just blacked out so you couldn't actually see. It actually took an illegal leak to get the real documents that were unredacted through. So the Freedom of Information Act was too weak. The government can redact what it sends out. So I'm going to challenge you on that, Matthew, but have another go.
Okay, the second thing you mentioned was about the Human Rights Act, and you said it was under threat. You said it was weak. The first point, it's not under threat in any real reality. The last time the Conservative Party wanted to get rid of it, replace it, was really under Theresa May. But she had to drop that in 2017 because she lost her majority. Lots of Conservative MPs were deeply opposed to getting rid of the Human Rights Act as well, not just Labour MPs, not just Liberal Democrats. It doesn't have widespread support to do that. You said it was weak as well. Well, there's lots of examples where the Human Rights Act has protected different groups.
Are you going to tell me about the elderly couple?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, the elderly couple that were separated into different care homes and then by the local authorities, and then under the Human Rights Act, their families sued and those local authorities were forced to put those that elderly couple who had been together for years and years back into one care home because of their right to a family right that's confirmed in the Human Rights
Act.
Well,
you've made my point for me then. I was going to also mention the idea of the Brewster case.
Oh, tell me about the Brewster case.
Cohabiting couples having the same rights as other couples as well. That's a very important case too. And increasingly we see our judges applying pressure on the government to make sure that even some groups' rights that we may not... A great example would be the Ashes Bakery case, where you had a case there of a business owned by a Christian couple, and they were asked to make a cake that had a pro-gay marriage message.
Support gay marriage, it seems.
It was about supporting gay marriage, absolutely. And the Supreme Court ruled that that business, they had the right, because they've got They are a religious group. They've got the right to not be forced to make that message. They were, that couple were very happy to bake that cake, make that cake. It was just about that message. So even though maybe a majority of people may want to quibble with that and say, oh, you can't possibly not make a cake that is pro-gay marriage, sometimes the Supreme Court is willing to step in for...
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court in that case basically confirmed the right of the individual to not be compelled to write something they don't believe in.
Yeah.
But by doing so, they supported the individual rights, but that then affected perhaps the collective rights of the gay community to have access to the same services that heterosexual couples have. So I think what we're seeing here is a kind of conflict between individualist and collectivist rights, and arguably collective rights, such as the right of trade unions to strike and so on, have been limited in recent years, whereas individual rights, potentially you could argue with the Human Rights Act, has furthered rights. You mentioned that judges are doing this job, they're upholding the Human Rights Act. But also in the Tory manifesto, not only do they want to update the Human Rights Act, they also want to review the power of the Supreme Court. I wonder why that is. Could it be that they ruled that Boris Johnson was not allowed to suspend prorogue Parliament in 2019 and therefore he's a bit cross?
I think that's a very cynical way of looking at it. But the third point that you made was about the rights of protest and that they're under threat.
Matthew and I have been on protest together, by the way, folks. We are good friends. Sorry, carry on. Yeah.
But I think if you look at Extinction Rebellion, you look at Black Lives Matter, there is a range of different groups that are out and about protesting all the time. You mentioned the vaccine, the anti-vaccine protests.
I didn't mention them.
You didn't mention them?
No.
Oh, okay.
So but go on, carry on.
I will mention them. Because they're another great example. We may not like their message. We may disagree with their message. But they've got the right to protest. They're protected by the police as well so that they can say what they want to say. So that is a minority group. Most people don't agree with them. But they're a minority group, a minority voice. They have the right to free speech. They go out and they are protected by the police even to make sure that they've got that right. They're not being attacked by the police. The opposite.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, won't we, after the policing bill and the elections bill will pass this year. Let's go on, Matthew, because we're running out of time and we need to look at our final topic, which is participation.
Do you know what really annoys me, Nick?
No.
What really grinds my gears is that there's too much information. There's too much content for our students to learn. It keeps me awake at night.
Right.
There's nothing really out there that summarises it well.
Well, let me introduce you, Matthew, to my new revision textbook, which does exactly that. It's the My Revision series from Hodder, and you can get it in all good bookshops, particularly Amazon. It's under a tenner, and I will leave the link in the show notes at the end of this podcast. So please, listener, do have a look at that and see if it's for you. I hope you find it useful. And Matthew, just to help you with this debate, you might want to turn to page 15 of this revision book, which is all about the participation crisis and do we have one. For a democracy to be true, to be healthy, you need participation, because it means that our leaders have greater legitimacy if, for example, they are put into office by a majority of the people. Matthew, tell us about participation in the UK and try and dispute this idea that there is a crisis.
Well, I could look at your book and say...
Please do.
..that Labour Party membership rose considerably after 2015 when Jeremy Corbyn became leader.
Right, so therefore
what a leader
people
he was.
Joining political parties, and therefore we don't have a participation crisis. That would be lovely, Matthew, if it weren't for the fact that only 1% of the public are members of political parties, and certainly now Corbyn's left, I don't think Labour Party membership is rising anymore. But carry on.
I could also look at your book on page 15 and say that from 2001 to 2017, general election turnout has steadily increased.
Well, it fell in 2019, didn't it?
That's what your book says.
Yes, my book says both. It says that there is a crisis and it gives your stats, and then it says there isn't a crisis. So it's a balanced book, just like this podcast. Hit me with another stat, Matthew.
Well, I could also have a look and say, well, there's a lot of petitions being signed. Perhaps one petition that really sticks in my mind is 6.1 million people signed the e-petition to stop Brexit or have a second referendum.
Yeah, that went well, didn't it? What I would say is that maybe signing petitions is a quick thing to do, so it's convenient. Maybe a bit too convenient, doesn't really get people involved. It gets people to click on a petition that their mate sent them and send it off and then forget about it. Is that really meaningful participation, Matthew?
Well, perhaps the most meaningful participation is my favourite thing, pressure groups. All those pressure groups out there, Extinction Rebellion, Black Lives Matter, the British Medical Association, loads of pressure groups out there, all sorts of different interests being mentioned, ways of getting involved, and also educating people about different issues that they may otherwise not heard about.
And we do see people taking direct action, perhaps more so than in the past, certainly when I was at university. But arguably, we go back to restrictions on the right to protest that we mentioned before. We could talk about the fact that many members of pressure groups are checkbook members. They pay membership fees and do little else. So there are some arguments to suggest that we do have a participation crisis and we don't, and you can get this information and more information from the new revision textbook that is now out. Matthew, I want to thank you so much for being here today in our little P106 studio. P106 is the classroom that we teach Lower 6 students to. Anything more to add about democracy, Matthew?
I think we've said it all.
I hope that you found this podcast useful. I hope you go away and then perhaps produce an evaluation of each section, looking at the four areas that we've covered, and that will help you perhaps to write essays where you introduce one view and then another, and then perhaps you provide mini summaries as you go along. There'll be more from us in the next couple of weeks. Until the next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.